Welcome to Getting Through It, where we're here to help you get through it. I'm John Bueri, and as always, I'm with the woman who the LA Times calls the Beyoncé of earthquakes, Dr. Lucy Jones. So let's get to it. Today, we're talking about how you can use the names and kinds of earthquakes to know what might come next in an earthquake sequence. And actually, it's more like why aftershocks are called aftershocks and how earthquakes get their names. That's what we're talking about. So Lucy, we always hear about earthquakes with names, like the Northridge earthquake of 1994 or the Ridgecrest earthquake of 2019. And then there are all the earthquakes that follow, and they don't get names. We call them aftershocks. So to start, how do you know if an earthquake is an aftershock or its own earthquake?
Well, really, an aftershock is an aftershock because a seismologist decided to say it was. A little more technically, earthquakes come in clusters. And so the biggest one we call the main shock, and the stuff that comes after it we call an aftershock. And it's just a semantic term to describe this feature of earthquakes, that they almost never happen alone.
And so what you're saying is that it's arbitrary. Let seismologists get together and say, oh, this is an aftershock or this isn't.
Well, it's not completely arbitrary. We come up with rules of thumbs. We recognize this feature that right after one earthquake, you're much more likely to have more, and it dies off with time. And the farther away you go, the less likely it is. So we've come up with these rules, and we say, all right, right when an earthquake happens, you can see how big the aftershock zone is. And we say that's the aftershock zone. And
how big is it?
Really extending out. All right, so bigger earthquakes happen on longer faults. So we have what we call the fault length, the length of the biggest earthquake, of the main shock. And then anything within one fault length of the fault, we will call aftershock. So if the fault is 10 miles long, anything that comes within 10 miles of any point on that 10-mile-long fault, that gets called an aftershock. And that's the area where we see them going on for a long time after the big earthquakes. We sometimes see right after, especially the biggest earthquakes happen, we'll see triggered earthquakes out to maybe 3 or 4 fault lengths. So for that 10-mile-long fault, maybe out to 40 miles away, we'll be seeing some extra earthquakes. Those die off more quickly, and we call them triggered earthquakes. And that name aftershock is really, by convention, been assigned to those ones that are closest to the fault that produces the first earthquake.
Okay, so what about the times when you have a big earthquake, a main shock, as you call it, and then there's a bigger earthquake that follows it? What's that? Then what do you do?
Then we change the names, and we go back and call the first one a foreshock, right? So the issue is that earthquakes happen in clusters. So every earthquake that happens makes another one more likely nearby and probably smaller. The overwhelming majority are a lot smaller. About 5% of the time, so about 1 out of every 20 earthquakes, the aftershock that it triggers will get bigger than the first earthquake. And then we change the name and call the first one a foreshock. We saw it in 2019 with the Ridgecrest earthquake. We had a 6.4, and the next day we had a 7.1. You can think of lots of other magnitude 6s in California that weren't followed by a bigger one. That Ridgecrest was that 1 in 20.
And this isn't just a California phenomenon, right? I think what happened in New Zealand back in, right? We had the Christchurch earthquake.
They had a very large aftershock sequence. So they had a magnitude 7. It was called the Darfield earthquake. And it was out west of the city of Christchurch. Christchurch is the second largest city. It's about 500,000 people. But the aftershock zone extended towards Christchurch. And there ended up being an aftershock at that end of the aftershock zone and right under the city of Christchurch. And that was a magnitude 6.1, about 6 months after the main shock. And it did way more damage than the first one because it was right underneath the city. And then about another half a year later, they had another magnitude 5.5 or so. And then another 5 months later, they had another 5.5. So they went through this it was very psychologically traumatic because it was like you think it's over and then it comes back on you again. And it was, that's a very energetic aftershock sequence, but it's maybe in the top 10% of what we see around the world. It wasn't unprecedented.
So what should you expect if you have a large earthquake? What should the aftershocks experience be that you would experience? How long will they last?
How long they last depends on how big the first earthquake was and actually by definition, how active the region was already. So we define it to be an aftershock as long as the rate of earthquakes that we're seeing is higher than it was before the main shock. There's sort of this jump up and very quick dying off and then a long tail. And in that long tail, mostly we get those smaller earthquakes. But one of the key issues, a lot of people say the number and magnitude dies off with time, and that's not true. Only the number dies off with time. The relative number of small to large is a constant feature. So that for every, magnitude 6, you'd expect to have 10 fives, 100 fours, 1,000 threes. Now, let's imagine that you've now had 1,000 threes or 2,000 threes coming along with another 6 would be, oh, right, that's this constant ratio thing. So large late aftershocks don't have to happen, but they're pretty common, and we expect to see them. Now, that duration, you should be thinking for the biggest earthquakes in terms of years. So say Northridge earthquake, we were above the background rate for about 6 years. Landers was a bit bigger, an earthquake, a 7.3, and we were above background there for closer to 10 years. And the biggest one we know, and it varies some, but in 1952, there was an earthquake in Kern County, a 7.5, and those aftershocks clearly continued up until about the 1990s, so something like 40 years. We stopped using the name aftershock because we thought people freaked out when we said that, but by our definition, they were still aftershocks.
And, we really only give names to the main shock, right? And so can you tell us what the process is? I mean, is it, I think I know the answer, but is it a group of people in a room that decide this? And which room is it? And can someone nominate a name for an earthquake?
I have nominated names and been voted down, too. So we tend to have a seismic network that's responsible for monitoring a region. And the operators of that network get to determine what the name is. We have some things we try to use. One is we don't bother to name every earthquake, right? We're going to record 50 earthquakes in Southern California today. We only name the ones that are big enough that we think we're going to need to talk about them later, which is basically about a magnitude 5. And we try to pick a feature nearby. We try to avoid using the names of cities when we can, because people tend to get upset. We both have people getting upset when we use their name and upset that we don't use their name. So
yeah,
like
I've heard
the 94 Northridge earthquake.
Right, exactly. I always hear people saying, hey, this is really, it really wasn't in Northridge. It was really centered in Reseda, right? And these are neighborhoods that are, next to each other, and they felt like they were being shortchanged because the earthquake wasn't named after them.
Right. Well, Northridge was upset because they felt like it was giving a bad reputation to Northridge, and Reseda was upset because the actual hypocenter was located under Reseda, and we should have gotten it. I actually wanted to call it the West San Fernando Valley earthquake because all of those regions were on top of the fault. But I got overruled on that one, that it was too long a name. We considered using Northridge Hills because at least that wasn't the name of a city. But there's a Northridge Hills fault, and it wasn't on the Northridge Hills fault. So we thought that would get confusing. And we ended up, we saw because of the damage to the Northridge Mall, the news media was already using that name. And one of the things we try to avoid if we can is getting in an argument with the media over what it should be called. So it's very much a personal process because it is about how do you talk about it. It's giving yourself a shorthand. I mean, because we could be saying, oh, the earthquake of January 17th, 1994, magnitude 6.7, but that's not an easy way to talk about it.
Right. And so you were outvoted on that one. Any name that you ever proposed that got taken?
I came up with Hector Mine. That was a way of having a location without people. But of course, there really weren't many towns in the neighborhood of that earthquake. It was out in the eastern Mojave. And I was part of the group that voted for North Palm Springs, a magnitude 6 in 1986. And we thought that was going to be more memorable than some of the other names. It was an area that didn't have many people, and most of the names we had, most people had never heard of. So it didn't give you a lot of information about where it was.
And why do you give them names? I mean, what's the point of naming an earthquake besides making it shorthand? What does that do for people?
So for the scientists, it's really about this is the way we can talk about it. But it also makes it, it gives focus for people thinking about it, because if it's just one other earthquake, when you've been traumatized, if you can, you know, focus in on the name, put it into something, it gives you a way to think about it and makes it easier to manage. We have joked about trying to, you know, just give them names like the hurricanes do, and let's call it Fred. But unlike hurricanes, there really is a specific location to an earthquake, and that helps people understand what it is. We do try to connect it with faults if we can. So I'm sure when or if in the next century we get an earthquake on the Hollywood Fault, it will be called the Hollywood Earthquake. Unfortunately, a lot of times we don't have an obvious fault to match up the earthquake with, or a named fault.
So how do you manage aftershocks? I mean, you've experienced them. I know you're working during a larger earthquake, and so you're busy, but they are still unsettling. I mean, you don't know when they're going to show up. You don't know how big they're going to be, and you don't know if that aftershock is going to turn into the main shock, and then what you experienced that was large already was the pre-shock. So the foreshock.
Right.
So how do you do it?
Well, yeah, I'm in a special place because I'm really busy, right? The aftershocks are the only earthquakes that we know exactly where and when they're going to be happening. I mean, not to the second, but I can tell you the day after magnitude 6, we're going to be recording a lot of earthquakes here today. And so there's a huge amount of work we need to do to make sure that we don't miss those earthquakes, that the recordings are as good as we can get. Maybe we're putting out portables, making sure all of the computer stuff is going on. And that keeps you from getting too freaked out, to be honest. The other thing is that I use statistics, right? That's been part of my research, is to look at the statistics of how these happen. And that's a way of sort of exerting control. I'm not actually controlling when and where the earthquake is happening, but I can tell myself, I can actually do the measurements. Is this going to be the rate at which we expect to see it? And does it stick with that rate? And quantifying it really does make it easier for me to think about them. I do remember one, actually a triggered earthquake, when we had the Landers earthquake in 1992. The day afterwards, there was a magnitude 4.2, I think it was, essentially under the seismolab in Pasadena, just a mile or two away. And there were a group of us that were talking. We were finally gotten a bit of a break after a day and a half of working very hard. And this earthquake happens right underneath us. So the first motions were really strong, and you could just feel the adrenaline rushing through everybody in the room. And then it stopped right away, because in fact, it wasn't that big an earthquake. It was that strong because it was so near us. And one of the guys quipped, now wait for the S wave, which actually put all of us into hysteria. We were like on the floor laughing, and you start going, okay, I think we're a little stressed out. So yes, we can get frightened too, but understanding that it's what's normal helps a lot.
So what I've heard you talk about today is that by putting a name to an earthquake, we give ourselves some control over that earthquake. And the idea that there's a certain rate that is constant with earthquakes. When you have big earthquakes, you expect a lot of aftershocks for a decent period of time based on that size of that main shock earthquake. And 5% of the times, one out of 20, that main shock might be followed by something larger. And that's what we've seen, in this Ridgecrest earthquake of 2019 here in Southern California. So what advice do you have to people who are experiencing a lot of earthquakes because they've experienced a main shock and they're in that aftershock sequence? What do you tell them?
Well, I think the same thing. You know, you can't control the earthquakes, but you can control your environment. Making sure there's nothing to fall on you, because you know now that you're going to be having earthquakes, that'll give you a sense of control. When you start feeling an earthquake, start counting and see how long it lasts. If it's only a second or two, you know it's a small earthquake. So now you can do a little bit of measurement yourself. If it lasts for 10 seconds, hey, you know you've gotten back up over magnitude 6 again. And so being able to be a bit of a scientist yourself, how do you experience it? But also remembering that this is normal. This is the structure that's expected, I think helps a lot, because earthquakes make us feel out of control, and anything we can do to make our lives feel under our control is going to make us feel better.
We could go on forever, as we always can, so we'll have to do this again. So until next time, I'm John Bueri with Dr. Lucy Jones, and you, Getting Through It. Getting Through It is a production of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Visit us online to get past shows and subscribe to get extras, insights, and access to the world of Getting Through It. Our music is performed by Josh Lee, and this closing music is written by our own Dr. Lucy Jones.